It is a privilege to be here today, passing on not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. And I know the talk today was supposed to be on Shohaku Okumura Roshi, but remembering that Ryokan was one of his designated four teachers, the other three being Sawaki Roshi, Uchiyama Roshi, and Dogen, I'm going to kind of segue into Ryokan today and next week to have a good view of who he was, knowing that Okumura Roshi took him for one of his four main teachers. And there's a book by Kaz Tanahashi called Sky Above, Great Wind, The Life and Poetry of Zen Master Ryokan, that I'm drawing from regarding just sketches from his life and poetry. And I think from this, you'll get a very clear idea of who Ryokan was. And he was like a secret person, but just absolutely incredible. So first, he kept what Kaz is a friend, so I'm just gonna call him Kaz. First, he kept extreme austerity in his Zazen practice. He lived alone in a very rural mountainous area in the snow country, which I don't know if you know about the snow country, but it gets like 12 feet of snow all winter and you're just snowed in, period. You're just, no one can walk. They end up digging out tunnels over walkways, but it's very rugged living, to say the least. And this is where Ryokan lived, close to the end of what's called the feudal Edo period, which is like early to middle 19th century. He wrote poems about hermetic life and also about the practice of takuhatsu, which is really why Shohaku Okumura changed from Dogen being his main teacher to Ryokan being his main kind of spiritual practice model. When we say takuhatsu, it's a whole encompassing way of life. This is where you get your food, so it's very important. And here's a poem by Ryokan about hermetic life. Only thing the thief left behind, moon in my window. And one just immediately feels the sparsity, made even sparser by the full moon. He wrote about the seasonal changes, the fragility of life, as well as the joy of seeing friends and playing with children, which he did a whole lot. And many of his poems are profoundly but subtly Buddhist. For example, within this serene snowfall, 1 billion worlds arise. In each, flurries come floating down. And this 1 billion worlds is a way of describing the entire universe in Buddhist scriptures. And Ryokan's imagery brings this vast cosmology into falling snow, and each snowdrop contains the whole world. So, and also the snow that falls on his thatch-roofed hut evokes the feeling of emptiness as well. And here's a haiku that presents the Zen paradox that flourishing is no different from withering. Falling blossoms. Blossoms in bloom are also falling blossoms. Ryokan was honest about his loneliness and yearning for human contact. He wrote in a highly refined classical style, often using archaic pillow words, which are just kind of modifiers. They're kind of set modifiers for certain words. They're used a lot in the Tale of Genji, for example, which was in the 12th century, or maybe 11th century. At the same time, his word, Ryokan's words express a very carefree warmth and love that touch a great number of people. And although he never published his own collections, his poems were collected even while he was alive and as well afterwards. And he's now regarded as one of the greatest poets of the Edo period, along with Basho, Busan, and Isa. So a well-known self-portrait of Ryokan in his own verse describes his lifestyle. It is not that I avoid mixing with the world, but I do better playing alone. He's just so simple. He just nails it every single time. There's a name of a person I can't pronounce, Yoshishige Kara, author of Anecdotes of Zen Master Ryokan, who knew Ryokan in his young days and describes him as full of lofty spirit, which was naturally expressed. He was tall and slender, like a Taoist sorcerer, with a high nose and long eyes. He was gentle, stern, and not presumptuous. Ryokan did not show excitement or anger. I never heard him speak fast. His way of eating and drinking was slow, almost like a fool. And certainly Ryokan was not well dressed. He wore the same tattered, simple black robe all the time. He had uncombed hair and an unshaven face and walked barefoot. And he would go into people's kitchens and beg food. Once when he visited a house, something valuable was stolen. People in the house thought Ryokan was the thief, escaped from prison. They summoned the villagers and blowing a conch shell, they summoned the villagers and with a rope, they bound him and started to bury him alive. But Ryokan didn't say a word. They just let him do what they wanted. But before they threw them in the hole, someone recognized him and said, what are you doing? This is the famous Zen master Ryokan. Untied the rope right away and apologize. And so the astonished villagers did that. But the person who rescued him said, why didn't you say that was a false accusation? And Ryokan said, all the villagers suspected me. Even if I had explained, that wouldn't have removed their suspicion. There's nothing better than saying nothing. There's nothing better than saying nothing. That's Ryokan to a T. There's nothing better than saying nothing. I mean, he was so passive in a way that you could almost criticize him for his passivity, and yet it came from this enormous strength. So we have to use non-discrimination here. Sometimes he accepted, this is very interesting. Sometimes he accepted invitations from his supporters to stay for meals or overnight. And one of them reflects, Ryokan stayed with us for a couple of days. A peaceful atmosphere filled our house, and everyone became harmonious. This atmosphere remained for some days, even after he left. As soon as I started talking with him, I realized that my heart had become pure. He did not explain Zen or other Buddhist scriptures, nor did he encourage wholesome actions. He didn't do that. He would burn firewood in the kitchen or sit in meditation in our living room. He did not talk about literature or ethics. He was indescribably relaxed. He taught others only by his presence. There is no doubt that Ryokan's sparse use or absence of words came from his lifelong practice of Zazen. An episode recorded by this same person beautifully illustrates Ryokan's thoughtful way of guiding a young person. This is a remarkable event, I think. The household of Ryokan's family, Yamamoto of Tachibana-ya, which means the village headman, was managed by his younger brother Yushi after Ryokan had left home and become a monk. So Ryokan was supposed to become that, but then he became a monk, so his younger brother became the village headman. Yushi's eldest son, Yumanosuke, was squandering the family money for his own personal pleasures. Asked by Yumanosuke's mother to give her son advice, this would be Ryokan's nephew, Ryokan went to the Tachibana-ya. He stayed there for 3 days, but said nothing. On his departure from the hermitage, Ryokan stood at the porch, called for Yumanosuke, and asked him to tie the strings of his straw sandals. Yumanosuke's mother, who stood behind the screen, was hoping that Ryokan would give him some strong words. Yumanosuke didn't understand why Ryokan had asked him to do such an unusual thing, but followed his request. So he's down there tying his sandals. As he bent to the task, he felt something wet on his neck. He was surprised and looked up. He saw Ryokan's eyes full of tears. At that moment, he felt repentance for his wrongdoings. Ryokan stood up and left without a word. That's all. Legend has it that he practiced his brushwork, for which he's famous, in the air. He was happy to do calligraphy for children. It is said when Ryokan was begging in the highway station town, a child with a sheet of paper came to him and said, "Reverend Ryokan, please write something on this paper." So Ryokan said, "What are you going to use it for?" "I'm going to make a kite and fly it. So please write some words to call the wind." Right away, Ryokan wrote 4 big characters: "Sky above, great wind," and gave the calligraphy to the child. We see vast freedom. These are words of Kaz, who is a very famous calligrapher. And he says, "We see vast freedom in his childlike brushstrokes, which demonstrate that Ryokan was a child when he was with children." And then Kaz goes on, "Because of the vulnerability and spiritual depth of the artist, because those things are revealed directly through drawn lines, calligraphy is regarded as the highest art form in all of East Asia. That is why the scroll of a Zen master is hung in the main alcove of a tea room, to remind the host and guests of the presence of an awakened person, ancient or contemporary." Later, Ryokan reflected on the days of his youth. "When I remember my youth reading books in an empty room, pouring oil into the lamp, savoring a long winter night. With so few words, he provides such a visceral experience. One feels one is inside the room with him. So from age 11, Azo, that's his childhood name, was sent to stay with relatives in a village 9 miles away. And as planned, during this time, he studied Chinese and Japanese literature at a private school run by Confucian scholars. So Azo's father, wanting to retire as village headman, made Azo the village headman in training at age 16. And so that's when he abruptly escaped becoming a novice at a Zen temple. The cause of his dropping out isn't clear. Legend has it that he was deeply distressed at witnessing the decapitation of a criminal. But another legend has it that he miserably failed to mediate a dispute between the samurai government's regional chief magistrate and the villagers, because he was too honest, lacked diplomacy, and offended both parties. At any rate, Azo proved himself to be unfit to be the part of the rigidly established feudal society and sought out inner wisdom and freedom instead. So think of how well he knew himself, though, at age 16. He's already saying, I can't be the village headman. It's not me, and I'm going to be a novice monk. Like, he knew that at age 16. At age 18, he was ordained by Genjo Haryo, H-A-R-Y-O, abbot of Kosho Temple, where he had taken refuge and was given the monk name Daigu Ryokan, meaning great fool, good and broad. 4 years later, Zen master Tainin Kokusen, Haryo's teacher and long-term abbot of Ensu Monastery, visited Kosho Temple to conduct an ordination ceremony. And Ryokan was very struck with Kokusen's humble and yet accomplished personality and became his student right away and accompanied him to Ensu Monastery in the western region of Honshō Island. The monastery, located atop an isolated round mountain, was relatively small. Kokusen had, however, established practice guidelines for Ensu Monastery and maintained strict communal routines, thereby elevating it to one of the top-ranking Dharma centers, Dharma training centers for Soto Zen, the Soto school. Kokusen diligently followed the Zen practice step established by Dogen, who emphasized that practice itself is enlightenment and prescribed minute details of daily monastic procedure. Ryokan joined other monks and participated in the rigorous daily schedule from early morning until late at night, meditating, cleaning the monastery, cutting firewood, cooking, serving, listening to Dharma talks, receiving personal instruction from the master, reading scriptures and Zen texts, and takahatsu. According to Ryokan, his master's teaching style was pulling boulders and carrying soil. It seems that much of Kokusen's instruction was giving through the silent joint endeavor of meditation and labor. And I'm just marveling at this, because Suzuki Roshi did the same thing. He was always lugging these boulders around. And I didn't know it was such a tradition as that. It's amazing to me that that kind of carrying soil and lugging boulders is a traditional monastic pastime of the abbots. So later, Ryokan wrote a poem about his training period. Since residing in the Ensu Monastery, how many winters and springs have passed? In the neighboring town of 1,000 houses, did I know a single person? When my robe got filthy, I washed it with my hands. When food was gone, I went to the city to beg. When I learned from biographies of accomplished monks, remaining poor suits us seekers well. He must have heard, Ryokan is reflecting, he must have heard Dogen's words, those who practice the way must be poor. But it's really not so much about money as about facing away from profit, fame, and comfort, really, all three. In 1790, at about age 33, Ryokan received a ritual stick with an approval verse from Kokusen. And this verse includes the words good, fool, and broad, which represent ideographs in Ryokan's name. So, and it says, my good fool, your way is broad, freely living as you are. Who can grasp you? Now I entrust you with a mountain-shaped stick. Wherever there is a wall, there's a place to doze. It's so great. Wherever there's a wall, there's a place to doze. It's perfect for Ryokan. So this was given to him by his teacher. So with this stick, Ryokan completed his Zen training. Then he left to further practice as a monk, wandering the world like clouds and water. And then Kokusen passed away the following year. So these are years that no one knows about. I think he wandered kind of visiting various monasteries and teachers. So in his pilgrimages, begging for food and lodging, Ryokan managed to make his way to many temples and monasteries all over Japan. But he became disappointed with the severe lack of genuine spirit among Buddhists in his time. All Japanese people were legally obliged to register at their Buddhist temples in order to prove that they were not believers in Christianity, which was strictly forbidden. Those not authorized by temples were stripped of their civil rights and regarded as non-humans. People were not allowed to change their temples. Priests received ample income by performing funerals and memorial ceremonies for the temple's member families. Temples owned farmlands from which they collected rice crop revenue through the labor of farmers fixed to the lands. I mean, this is really feudal. Monks were supposed to be celibate, but many of them were unofficially married. Ryokan saw these phenomena as signs of corruption and a decline of the Dharma, writing in the poem entitled Monks, "You who have left the household, I hear you shouting day and night. In order to satisfy your mouths and stomachs, you run around all your lives." And particularly criticizing Buddhist sectarianism, Ryokan wrote this as part of a long poem, Discourse. This is just a part of a long poem. "The ancestral way becomes fainter day by day. Teachers can't see past the name of their school. Students enable their teachers' narrow-mindedness. They glue to each other, unwilling to change. If the purpose of the Dharma were to establish schools, sages would have done so long ago. Now that people have declared their schools, whom on earth should I join?" Dogen was fierce on the subject of sectarianism. He denied the famous five schools of Zen in China. He criticized all the smaller sects of Zen. He even criticized the word Zen. And he said that practice simply was about the Buddha Dharma. This is about the Buddha Dharma. There's no, forget Zen, forget Rinzai, forget Soto, forget all these, there were many schools, so forget all of them. And Ryokan was very much in line with that. So he lived in several places near his hometown, Izumo-saki. And then around 1976, at the age of 39, he settled in this thatch-roofed hut on a steep hill of Mount Kugami, about 12 miles from the port village. The name, which means province top, stands high in Echigo. This was his province. It houses the Kokuji Temple, a large ancient Shinyan school temple, and there's another sanctuary called Hongaku Temple down below on the western slope, and there, and that's where Ryokan was invited to live in a one-room hermitage called Five Scoop Hut behind the temple. This hut had been built sometime earlier for a monk who helped rebuild the temple on an allowance of five small scoops of rice a day. So Ryokan lived in this little hut called Five Scoop Hut, and he lived there for 20 years, from age 39 to 59. And it may seem as the mature period of his poetry and calligraphy, when he established his own poetic voice and found his unique style of calligraphy. I think he really was comfortable there, but it's pretty far to walk, 24 miles. The writings of Dogen were forgotten for 400 years after his death, and Ryokan might not have been fully aware of it, but there had been a resurgence in Dogen studies since the 17th century, in which his teacher, Kokusen, played a part. A copy of Continuous Practice, which Ryokan had borrowed from a friend, that's a Dogen piece, was perhaps printed and distributed by his Dharma brother. But there were initial publications of the whole Shobo Genzo, but a lot of the publications disappeared, and Ryokan had no way really to acquire a text. But he might have had access to some of these handwritten smaller pieces. Nevertheless, it was not in his nature to remain in a monastery and lead a community of monks and try and reform the system. He saw himself as ill-suited to preach, organize, or lead. He was self-disciplined, but inwardly inclined, he wrote, "I don't tell the murky world to turn pure. I purify myself and check my reflection in the water of the valley brook." I love that. "I purify myself and check my reflection in the water of the valley brook." Withdrawing from practicing community, from a practicing community, he walked alone through the mountains, and ringing his belled staff and chanting a verse of sutra at each house. And he treated everyone with respect and loving kindness. Whether people offered him food, ignored him, or harshly drove him away, he was determined to remain true to his path as a monk. "Never will I taint my renounced life for the Buddha, for the Dharma." There was at least one person who practiced Zen really seriously with Ryokan. It, and that was his boyhood friend, Saichi Miwa. But he died really young. And hearing the sad news, Ryokan wrote, the single lay practitioner who studied with me for 20 years, one who penetrated what is within, no others are worthy of receiving the Dharma. So in the meantime, while Ryokan was living at Five Scoop Hut, his brother Yushi gradually failed to manage the headman's office as well as the family household. And as a result of losing a court dispute, the entire property of the Yamamoto family was confiscated by the government, and Yushi was expelled from his home village. At the death of his wife, Yasu, a grief-stricken Yushi became a monk. But Ryokan unconditionally loved his haiku poet sibling, and at times they saw and wrote to each other. Once Ryokan wrote him a tanka entitled Izumosaki Peninsula. That's the title of the poem. Morning and evening, I gazed at Sado Island, remembering our deceased mother. At age 59, he moved to the forested compound of a Shinto shrine located below the Five Scoop Hut. And it had become increasingly difficult for him to make trips through the deep snow to villages from the Five Scoop Hut. His two-room hut at the shrine stood at the side of its tiny thatched roof sanctuary, and he lived there for 10 years. This era can be regarded as the later period in his poetry and calligraphy. Despite his struggle with malnourishment and sickness, he was quite prolific, and it was during this time that he wrote, "When young, I learned literature, but was too lazy to become a scholar. Still young, I practiced Zen, but I never transmitted the Dharma. Now I live in a hermitage and guard a Shinto shrine. I feel like half a shrine keeper and half a monk." So then there's love in Ryokan's final years. This is so touching. So love. And Ryokan says, "Although I wish to come on a cane to see you, this sickly body will not let me." That's his poem. In 826, at age 69, he became too weak to collect firewood, fetch water, and walk the distance to the villages for Takuhatsu. And one of his students, an influential supporter of his, invited him to move to his house in a section of the village, Washima village, on the plain midpoint between Izumosaki and Mount Kumani. So Ryokan accepted his invitation, but insisted on living in the former firewood shed behind the garden. So he wouldn't live in the home, but he would live in a firewood shed, former firewood shed. And it's there that he spent his last 5 years. And this era can be regarded as the final period in his poetry and calligraphy. So one day in the following year, Taishin, a young nun, came to meet him. She left a tanka for him as he was away. "You who play in the Buddha way, bouncing a ball endlessly, must be the one. Is it your Dharma?" And Ryokan sent a return poem. "Try bouncing a ball. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. you end a 10 and start again. So later they met. Taishen, already an accomplished poet, passionately wrote, "The joy of meeting you in this way, I wonder if it is a dream I have not awoken from." And Ryokan responded reflectively and a little impersonally, "In the dream world, there is dozing. Further within, speaking and dreaming of the dream as it is." So Ryokan, a shabby old monk, must have been utterly flattered by this young, beautiful woman's subtle yet public confession of love. The notion of love between a nun and a monk would be dangerous anywhere, particularly in their old-fashioned rural society. So in his return poem, he told her jokingly to slow down. "I wish I could bring you along, but what would become of us if people started to talk?" But his love of Taishen deepened. And while suffering from deteriorating health and persistent diarrhea, he became eager to see her. He wrote, "Have you forgotten? Has the path disappeared? These days I have spent waiting and waiting, but you have not yet arrived." When she came after the snow melted, he wrote, "More precious than jewels and gold spread under the sky, your visit at the beginning of spring." And finally, here is my very favorite. So her poem entitled, "On My First Visit to Ryokan." "Wondering if it's a dream, I'm filled with joy. Never awake me. If it's a dream, leave me, please, in this joy forever." Taishen. And his answer: "Slumbering in the dreamland, talking about the dream, why not float our dream on the stream of eternity?" And one of Ryokan's death poems summarizes his lifelong loneliness, openness, and reconciliation with transiency. "Showing its back and showing its front, a falling maple leaf." I don't feel the need to point out the most important things, but I would like you to reflect this week on the following. Qualities in Ryokan that you admire and emulate. Qualities in Ryokan that you don't admire. Qualities in Ryokan that you feel connect him with Dogen. qualities in Ryokan that show his stamina and strength, the opposite of his more often emphasized childlike spirit. Question, what do you think of Ryokan's statement, there is nothing better than saying nothing? What do you think of that? And finally, the sentence, he was indescribably relaxed. He taught others only by his presence. Given his hard life with severe difficulties, how do you think he managed this? Indescribably relaxed and teaching only by his presence. How did he manage? How did he manage? And I wonder if you have questions.
Yes, Gail. The first question that we have is, for me, the story about the mother who hoped Ryokan would reform her son who was squandering the family resources was so moving. This is silly, but do you think he planned what ended up happening? It's hard to plan crying. I wonder how he pulled that off.
You know, your question points to exactly what's so special about Ryokan, which is that his attunement to the kind of like universal flow, he was one with universal energy. It's really clear. And he was deeply unsuited to being village headman. I mean, I could hardly imagine him doing that, but he knew that he was unsuited and he entered a monastery instead at age, 16? And many of us, as I know from people who are struggling still with writing their vow, who are way older than 16, don't yet know. They don't yet know. Who am I? The first question of the 10 questions, who am I in order to write your vow? Ryokan knew that at age 16. So because he was in tune with that universal energy, he could trust the situation. So because he could trust the situation to establish the correct solution to the situation, he could let go of control. So letting go, and I don't think he planned it at all. And if he had planned it, it wouldn't have had been nearly as effective in changing this child's life. This child was like going nowhere very fast and bringing his family down with him. And Ryokan's weeping touched him so much that he switched gears. But you can't, like you're saying, you can't plan crying, but he didn't need to plan anything. He just left himself to being present and being present with this boy who's destroying himself at such a young age is weepable. And Ryokan wept. So I'm saying, no, I don't think he planned it. I don't think he was trying to control anything ever, really. And which is what we as we're supposed to be doing, giving over control, because if you recall the teaching, it was everything that comes to us is a gift. Everything that comes to us is a gift, and everything comes to us. We don't go to it. Everything comes to us and maintains itself with us, instead of we go to it and try to manipulate what things should be. That's a great, that's probably the most important teaching in Dogen's Genjo Koan, which I hope will be the subject of our next series. And it's one of his main books in the Shogo Genzo, and it's a really, really, really good entry point to Dogen. So that's what I'm planning. Anyway, I hope I answered your question. And the question is, the answer is no, he didn't plan his crime, but he allowed himself to be fully present and not controlling anything. And of course, weeping happened, because that was the natural response to such a pitiful situation. That's all.
Thank you, Gail. The next one we have is, had I been Ryokan and the people around me were trying to bury me alive, I definitely would have screamed and yelled. His reasoning that they wouldn't have believed me anyway, true, though it maybe wouldn't have stopped me. It would be instinctual to protest being murdered. I don't see how he could have done that.
Well, as I was just saying, Ryokan, I mean, one of the reasons his poems are so exquisite, even though they almost could be, you know, a second grader could practically write them, but not really. They're so exquisite because they're absolutely in tune with the present moment. And he was so in tune with the present moment that if everyone wanted him to die, if that's what everyone wanted, then he was just gonna be, he would die. But he wouldn't think of it that way. He would think of it as rejoining universal life. And we all actually are rejoining universal life every minute. That's the meaning of that last poem that I love so much, showing its back and showing its front, a falling maple leaf. Showing its back and showing its front, showing its universal life, showing its universal death. Everything manifests itself as it should, in the right way. And so Ryokan felt this so strongly. Don't forget, he was an enlightened monk, and he not only felt it, but that's what his reality was. He understood the deeper reality that took away the urgency of, no, I have to have my life right now. And then from all accounts, we see his extreme quietness, like that kind of act, that weeping act was just Ryokan being so quiet that he melted into the absolute present moment of his heart breaking over this boy who was ruining his life. Even after he left visiting a household, the household was peaceful for the next week. I think he would have been fine with anything interconnected. But he understood the interconnectedness of life, you know, as dependent co-arising. He was fully in tune with that. And so he would just rejoin the flow of dependent co-arising of universal life. That's my answer. If you understand, I think you'll really appreciate who Ryokan is.
Thank you, Gail. The next question that we have is the love relationship with the nun unusual for monks of that stature? Or is it just a case of him revealing and writing about it, whereas others didn't?
I feel I can pretty confidently answer your question. No, others didn't write about this, and it didn't happen to others. And the reason why I'm saying that is that Tenshin was a extremely accomplished poet. And from that accomplishment, she was drawn and approached Ryokan, and they met. Their love was seeing someone else whose relationship with writing had the same depth. And you don't find that, you know, any Tom, Dick, and Harry. I hope that doesn't sound gender something. He was a very, very accomplished poet, like one of the greats of his period, one of the four great poets, maybe of this kind of poetry ever. And she was also a very, very accomplished poet. And so they met in this interior world that is really special and really unique to each of them. And then they saw each other and they fell in love. And it's kind of it's really like a miracle that happened. After Ryokan died, she took over handling, organizing his poetry and putting it together for publication. She became a great part. She became a huge part of the way it's presented to us now. She kind of took over that whole support person's position. Behind any great artist, there's always a support person. And she became his support person after he died. And it's wonderful that the whole thing was wonderful. I'm so glad he had that experience before he died. By the way, there's a statue in iron, like there's this iron, or it might be bronze. I'm sure it's bronze. There's a bronze statue of the two in that city where he lived, in front of the museum, Ryokan's museum. It's the most gorgeous statue of him sitting in seiza, sitting in like a zazen position, and her also cross-legged facing him, and they're talking to each other and leaning toward each other. And it's all in bronze. And the last two poems I read you that I said were my favorite, those are engraved on the statue in the city. And there's photographs of them. Oh my gosh, it's so moving. I'm just very touched by it. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next question is, what is Takahatsu?
Yes, a lot of people are really confused about it because of the word begging that's used as a translation word. And the word begging evokes, you know, like people on the street with not necessarily any practice. And Takuhatsu is an extremely ritualized practice that goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha, whose whole community was organized around Takuhatsu. Because imagine this great number of monks who lived in the forest. How were they going to get food? And the way they got food is they all together in a group went out with their bowls. They had a bowl. They hardly owned anything, but one of the things they owned was a bowl. And they ritually, I think they split up so they didn't overwhelm any one neighborhood, but they ritually went to a neighborhood and then they stood in front of each house holding their bowl. And either someone came out from the house or someone didn't come out from the house. And if they didn't, they went to the next house. But the point of it was, number one, to give the giver of the food an opportunity for giving, giving being one of the first of the six paramitas. We had a whole series on the paramitas, which are called perfections. And giving is considered, you know, it's an activity that goes beyond us. It's a perfection activity that goes beyond the person who gives. And so begging allows the person to give, which is a wonderful activity in the first place. In the second place, in return for the offering, the monk gives the Dharma. The monk gives either a prayer or a teaching, possibly a teeny, you know, 2-minute Dharma talk. So there's the giving on the monk's part, giving of, so both are giving, and also the receiving of sustenance or food on the monk's part, and on the giver's part, the householder's part, receiving the Dharma. So it was a terrific kind of exchange. I think the villagers very much appreciated the monk's presence. On the whole, I think it was a wonderful practice. And I know that even when Shakyamuni was originally began this practice, a wealthy villager, or maybe, you know, part of the aristocracy, offered him food every day. You know, I'll bring you food every day, no worries. And he said he accepted that, but some days anyway, he would want to go and beg because he wanted to get to know the villagers. And I think for him, whose main job in the world from then on was teaching the Dharma. That's what he was living for after he attained enlightenment. So he definitely wanted to go to the village to meet the villagers so that he could offer teaching, that he could teach the Dharma to the villagers. And then he spread himself out. He walked to other villages and did the same thing. So I think I'll say this one more thing. When Okumura Roshi left America and went back to Japan and he was ill, he used Takuhatsu to feed himself. And I think that by that time, when he went out, he did go out with a bowl and did the same thing. Whatever street he picked, he went to every single place, even a butcher shop or even a bank, but I think they gave him money. And I think he only went out a couple of times a month. So I think it's changed. It's still done, but it's changed. I don't think you get food in your bowl, like a potato. I don't think you get that. All right, I think I need to stop. And I want to thank my team, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, for making these talks possible, which I so value, and I hope you value them too. I will see you next week. Bye-bye.